Mini-episode 603 of the FDH Lounge is brought to you by Sportsology, delivering unconventional columns and webcasts about sports, TV, music, movies, and more. Follow them on the web at Sportsology.com.
The FDH Lounge. You want to schedule your life around it.
A long time ago, on a gloomy, wet Cleveland spring night, two men stand alone amidst the late night drizzle. Their voices echo across the vacant station parking lot as they debate the merits of the great American radio show that have been missing for far too long. On that night, an idea was born. That idea became the FDH Lounge. Welcome to the FDH Lounge.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to FDH Lounge, mini episode number 603. This is FDH managing partner Rick Morris. We have a very special treat for you today, previewing the 2015 fall TV season, and we've got two great pros on with us to do that. One is one of our ongoing FDH Lounge dignitaries, one of our great contributors, Adam Buckman, our good friend from Media Post and TV Howl, and of course, author of the great book Jerk, which is his memoirs for the TV business. I trust that is still doing well at Amazon. Adam, a pleasure as always. I was looking forward to getting you back on the show. Good to have you on, my man.
It's so great to be back. It's been a while, and I'm just really always flattered to be asked, to be honest with you.
Well, I wish we were able to do this more often, and it's up to me. You know, I come to think of it, I handle a lot of the scheduling, so I'm in position to make that happen, and we'll definitely have to do that, make it happen more often. You are being joined, of course, today by another great pro in the media business, a gentleman covering the media beat, advertising specifically, for a good long time, Stuart Elliott, presently of Media Village and a past guest on the show. Happy to welcome him back. Stuart, welcome to the FDH Lounge, sir. How are you today?
Good. I'm very good. Thank you for having me on.
It's a pleasure to be able to put you two guys together on this panel and look at the fall TV season from a couple of different angles here. Really looking forward to doing this. I want to lead with something here and get some thoughts from both of you and use a jumping off point. Actually, Adam, for one of your columns at Media Post, as I was doing some prep here, getting ready for today, an observation that you had made, this isn't really about the fall TV season per se, because we usually take that to mean prime time, but in the sense that TV as a whole really kind of gears towards this, you have Scott Van Pelt sort of redefining SportsCenter at midnight. That started on Labor Day. The next night, of course, you had Stephen Colbert taking over the Late Show on CBS, and you had made an observation in your column that I thought was very, very interesting about that, about him not necessarily trying to shoehorn comedy into his interviews. And you were kind of speculating how that was going to go and taking more of a general kind of see where it goes kind of attitude that is sort of atypical of late night. So you had written that before his debut. So I'd like to get a sense from you, from having watched it thus far, has it really sort of lived to that standard as far as what you expected, as far as him kind of letting the interviews breathe and not forcing the comedy in there? And what have you thought of it overall as far as his competitiveness on the landscape?
Well, I'll try to keep this as brief as possible, but I must thank you for your readership. It's really nice that you sought out the columns on Media Post. The first one you're talking about was, I think when they announced, when CBS announced Steve Colbert's first week guest list, you know, a couple of weeks before the premiere, I wrote a column that made note of some of the guests that he was having that weren't the same old guests. They weren't from the entertainment business. He was planning to have and did have last week Elon Musk of the Tesla automobile company, and he also had the other guy that founded the Uber company, and indeed had Vice President Joe Biden. And in a way, the Joe Biden interview is the best example of what they were trying to say in that press release, which was that Colbert will do the unexpected when it comes to booking people. It won't necessarily be, you know, movie stars with a new movie premiering that weekend, although I'm sure he'll have plenty of them. And then I wondered, sarcastically as usual, whether actually interviewing somebody seriously on a late-night show would in any way work or more to the point, set his show apart from his competitors. And indeed, this has come to pass. He has already established himself as a guy who can do all the comedy in the world and then veer off into sort of serious interview territory, as he did with Vice President Biden, where the two of them talked about very terrible personal tragedies that had occurred to family members, you know, in each of their families. And it wasn't really a maudlin conversation. It was a very enlightening and very illuminating look at what people go through when they have these terrible things happen to them. And so, you know, I don't know what was going on the Fallon show at that moment, but probably, you know, he was throwing a pie at somebody. You know what I mean? So there's just this contrast. And will it work in the sense that you know, will Colbert take his interview skills, combining them with his comedy skills, to overtake Jimmy Fallon in the ratings? Well, it's much too early to tell. But I think he has already established a kind of a niche for himself that neither of his two competitors, the two Jimmys, can do. And I think that's important for him to do, because I think with three shows, you know, you got to set yourself apart. And I think it's a gutsy move, and I think he just may succeed at it.
Absolutely, and it's something that caught my eye when you were talking about this, because again, you know, on a smaller level, certain to be sure, but that's kind of what we try to do on this show, just kind of go where the conversations take us, and
yeah,
that's really, again, kind of a niche thing as opposed to trying to be bigger and broader and try to get to different things here. You know, trusting in the conversation to lead you to the right place and to be entertaining and informative is not exactly a mainstream thing these days, sadly enough. So that kind of segues to what I want to ask you about this, Stuart, from your beat. In looking at this, you have Stephen Colbert determined at 11:35, really apparently to try to be himself here and to try to bring these things to the format. Jimmy Fallon, him being himself, translating 12:30, that worked for him. Ratings-wise, it didn't really work so much for Conan when he tried to do the same thing a couple of years ago and not really make the alterations. David Letterman is, of course, famous for having made his alterations at 11:35 and really not doing the same kind of show that was catering to the college kids at 12:30. So what's your sense from an advertising perspective and anything else personally from your perspective as far as what Colbert is trying to do here?
Well, I think what's interesting is that you've got an enormous amount of focus and attention on these shows, on late night, on broadcast network television. And in a couple of weeks, we're going to have Trevor Noah show up on The Daily Show, and that's going to generate even more conversation about all of this with the angle of the broadcast versus the cable. I think what's interesting is that for all the pitfalls and perils that television is being subjected to these days, there still remains an enormous amount of business being done involving these shows, which are decades and decades old, if you look back to who was hosting them originally. I mean, The Tonight Show is like, what, 60 years old now, if not more?
Yep.
It's a really interesting phenomenon, and the efforts by the media to sort of try to instigate some sort of a war among the two Jimmys and Stephen Colbert is another wrinkle in this, and the interest that Stephen Colbert has in doing special advertising segments for sponsors, which David Letterman was never a big fan of. Now you have all three of those shows, both Jimmy Fallon and Jimmy Kimmel have been doing those branded integrations for quite some time, and now Colbert is willing to do them too, as evidenced in his first show where he came right out of the box and did that funny bit about
Sabra hummus.
About Sabra hummus.
Exactly.
And how this mystical amulet is going to be forcing him to do commercials throughout the run of his hostdom on the show. And that was just like a fantastically funny framing device, which will let him let him sell his head off now as he pretends to be under the thrall of this amulet that forces him to praise sponsors.
A very clever device, certainly, and again, in characteristic fashion, he has been able to make it work here. I'm gonna go back and forth with you guys rotating here. So I'll start with this one with you, Stuart. Big picture, staying here for a moment, looking at CBS overall, of course. Only number two last year in the 18 to 49 prize demographic, but tops overall, which is not too surprising because whenever you factor in the older people, CBS is always going to do well there. They obviously have great aspirations for this year as far as sweeping the board in both categories with having the Super Bowl, and we all know what a great promotional vehicle that can be. So in terms of the overall competitiveness of the TV landscape this year, how big of a favorite should CBS be over the other networks as far as being number one in both of those?
Well, I think what's interesting is that every year everyone looks down their nose at CBS and their lineup of procedurals and sitcoms and other programming fare. But they really do know how to present what people want. And it always interests me how so few of the shows on CBS ever get any attention and publicity among the critics and the feature articles in entertainment magazines and on the blogs. But there they are year after year hitting, to use a baseball analogy, every year they come to bat and they're hitting doubles, solid doubles every single year. I think this year they're going to try to go a little younger. All the networks, the broadcast networks, are having the problem that they're aging up as the younger people get less and less used to watching TV on TV. So I think CBS is going to try to do something this year, particularly with the program Supergirl, which is very much not in the typical CBS wheelhouse in terms of the target. So it's going to be very interesting to see. And I saw the news today that Nina Tassler is stepping down, and you really have to hand it to her. She's done an amazing job over the years keeping this big mainstream ocean liner afloat in the sea of television. And every year CBS gets snickered at, and every year they wind up delivering coming in very close to first, if not first.
Absolutely, and you're right about that in terms of her delivering on the metrics, because at the end of the day, that's what she gets paid for. And for all the critics out there, and I have now dipped my toe in the water a little bit at notjustanothertvsite.com, for all of us that have written about TV, whether it be a little bit like me or more so like you guys, you guys, of course, know that, of course, it's the numbers that rule the day, and that's what made her very successful, regardless of what anyone thinks of the quality of the shows. But in terms of that, Adam, I'm just kind of struck by, as we talk about the shows, you look at the long-running success of something like NCIS, which has spun off a couple of different iterations here and itself shows no signs of slowing down. Mm-hmm. CBS is really interesting to me in the regards of having things that go on for a long period of time, really without leaving any footprints in the sand. I mean, if you were to tune into an NCIS episode that's replaying on USA Network, it could have been from, say, 2007, and I'm not sure there would be too much different than anything you see today, maybe the characters or whatever, but they keep finding a way to make it work, and they seem to have that magical formula, and it's the kind of thing Stuart mentioned about trying to find a younger audience, and that's what they all have to do to whatever degree. But what are your thoughts on what has made CBS so spectacularly successful in terms of the bottom line over this period of time?
Well, I think, you know, Stuart alluded to, you know, part of what I'm going to answer on that, which is that, you know, he's right. They're not the shows people, quote unquote, talk about. They're the shows everyone watches. So, and there's a great, there must be a really great skill that's unheralded, perhaps. I mean, I think some people in the trade press who know television have written about how skillful, you know, people like Nina Tassler are, and perhaps the person taking over her, this Glenn Geller at CBS, are at maintaining a kind of stability by really managing the way that the shows are made. I mean, I'll say this about CBS as opposed to, say, or at least what you hear about HBO and, let's say, FX, for example. I think the CBS programming executives' fingers are in every show. I mean, I think they really participate in every aspect of them. They massage them. They put them in sort of a meat grinder, and maybe they come out a little bland for the critics' tastes. But they seem to sort of occupy that great big middle-of-the-road area where you can just get the most people to watch them. I think that's a great skill. I think, in a weird way, as difficult as it must be to sort of write and create a Game of Thrones or a Mad Men or any one of these shows that you know we talk about a lot, like Breaking Bad, to make shows that consistently deliver many, many more viewers than most of those shows, with the exception of The Walking Dead, and make them and create for your sponsors an advertising environment that is consistent year after year after year. The only flaw to this program of programs at CBS would seem to be that the time might be coming that you can't any longer conduct network television business in the way that they seem hell-bent on conducting it until basically hell freezes over. And I guess this is what snipers would say about them, that, you know, they're living in a dream world where people are going to continue to watch shows like Blue Bloods in the future. But on the other hand, CBS can say, we're making money hand over fist. We would be stupid to start not doing what we do so well. So there it is. I find them to be a fascinating network, actually, in many ways, but not with their shows. The shows themselves are not that fascinating.
It's the story behind the story that's more interesting.
Yeah,
and
in
that's
a way,
an excellent educated supposition, no question about that. They probably do, you know, you don't just have shows that fit a formula like that by happenstance. There probably is a lot of active participation.
Exactly.
I hadn't really thought of it that way.
Yeah.
I think that's definitely true. Stuart, what's your perspective on this? With everything that CBS has been able to do and maintain this incredible stability over a period of time, with of course, primetime TV being such an inherently unstable prism to begin with here, with winners and losers at some networks almost changing by the year. The Tiffany Network just keeps on keeping on, and again, whether it's by a studious adherence to a formula, as has been posited by Adam, or whatever it may be. What are your thoughts on how they've been able to do this and how they are regarded by the advertising community?
Well, I think it's pretty clear that they've figured it out. They figured out this way to tackle the medium as it is and what the audience wants presently. You can make a case that maybe they're not moving fast enough to address the challenges and the changes that are on the horizon, and I know that every year the critics keep saying, oh, look, CBS is bringing back all these shows that are these big mainstream stalwart mass types of TV programs, like the CSIs, like the NCISs, and so on and so forth. But again, it's a tricky job, and it's tough. You know, a lot of us who are on the sidelines critiquing what they do, I don't know if we could do it. I mean, particularly at CBS, where they know they need to be a little bit ahead of the curve or move faster in getting ahead of the curve, but at the same time, there's only so far they can take their audience with them, or so fast that they could take that audience with them in terms of changing what they do and how they do it. And as I said previously, I think Supergirl is a good example of them trying to move the stake in the ground a few yards in a different direction in the middle of continuing to program all of their stalwart mainstream series. I mean, they're not. There was a period, I guess it was like 20 years ago, when a past regime at CBS canceled a lot of shows and suddenly put on a long list of programs that were aimed at a younger audience, and it was a disaster. And every one of those shows had to be canceled within the 18 months later. They were all gone, and they had to start from scratch. So it's a real skill to be able to do this. I think, you know, the CW is another example where they sort of were pivoting maybe in a different direction, in the sense that they were trying to get older and they were trying to get more male, and they were doing it at the same time. They had a whole bunch of shows on the air that were young, skewing younger and skewing female. And you don't just cancel. It's just throwing them all off the schedule and putting on a whole bunch of untested new programs is drastic, but it's not the way to do it. And again, you have to. It's fascinating to watch the calibration that goes into these decisions to sort of move the schedule this way or that way, while at the same time keeping the lights on every night and continuing to programming.
Absolutely. Adherence to a winning formula, I mean, that's something that has to be respected in a bottom-line business. And with CBS's dominance continuing from the previous decade, of course, that's been one of the big stories halfway through this decade. Another has been, you alluded to it there, with CBS dipping their toe in the water here with Supergirl, this deal in recent years, superheroes and comics, that those have been very big and continuing to go forward. And you have Heroes coming back this year that is joining that trend there. So what do you think about how that's going? And every year it seems like whenever I'm doing a fall TV preview, I always ask the question of whether this trend shows any signs of abating, and the answer always seems to be no. It seems like the networks are continuing to find a way to serve this audience in new ways that keep them tuned in year after year, don't they?
It's clear that this is a larger cultural trend, as evidenced by what's been going on in the movies for the past several years. But,
right.
You know, a lot of people pointed out this past summer, they sort of were looking at the chicken entrails and sort of seeing maybe some signs that the audience was starting to lose its interest in these programs. So television is an imitative medium. It's rare that television pioneers something. It usually comes out of some place, and clearly the interest that the moviegoers have shown in the superhero and the hero genre is what's led to it to go on television. Again, maybe there's some feeling that maybe there's sort of a high tide on this. And again, you could look at some of these shows and say that, oh, you know, they're not all the same. Some of them are a little more knowing, and some of them it's like a meta commentary on superheroes. And clearly you can say that what ABC has been doing with the Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. I don't think ever really has lived up to its potential. And then the Agent Carter, which I enjoyed, by the way, but I guess was very low-rated, but it's coming back anyway. And there may be another one that they're thinking of putting on. Some of these things are corporate decisions. I mean, now that the Marvel characters are part of the Disney world, they're going to show up on ABC.
That's right. That kind of synergy is always going to be something that it could play in when you're looking at the bringing together of big brands like that. And along those lines, Adam, my question mm-hmm. for you is, when you look at how some of the big box office movies that Stuart has referenced here, how some of them have done, not every superhero movie in the last year or so has really lived up to the expectations financially. Some of them are a little bit more flaccid than the studios might have liked. Is there a chance that that might be something of a canary in the coal mine as far as how it translates to TV? Or do you think that the series that are on primetime TV are distinct and that people are identifying with those brands specifically and loyal, even if some of the summer movies don't seem to do as well?
I'm not sure it's easy to generalize about superheroes as a genre on television.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's some examples on the CW now that are doing well in their universe, and they're very happy with those. And in a way, I'm a little surprised to see Supergirl on CBS because it feels more like a CW kind of a show. But what's interesting to me is...
But that may be why CBS is putting it on.
Well, that could be. In a way, it doesn't differ. In the fact that it has a young heroine, it's not that much different from shows you might not consider to be and would not consider to be superhero shows. For example, you know, the youthful team of geniuses on Scorpion, for example.
Right.
Or coming up on Fox, the youthful main characters of Minority Report, this sort of futuristic sci-fi cop show.
The joke always is that on CBS there's always an older but wiser mentor who oversees the young, impetuous, attractive team of sleuth/crime solvers/heroes and whatever. And, of course, everybody always jokes that that's a proxy for Les Moonves.
For me, the big difference between the movies and television is sort of the intimacy of it, of television entertainment. And I think that blockbuster superhero movies are so much different from television in that regard because they're supposed to fill IMAX screens and giant movie theater screens with you know their action. And to my mind, superhero derring do might not even translate all that well to the small screen.
I'm not
someone who watches them. No.
Do you watch The Flash?
No, I do not.
I think they've done an excellent job there in
making
sort of,
it TV-sized in a way.
Yeah, I mean, TV-sized. There's enough of the special effects and the high energy scenes sprinkled in to satisfy the movie goer in you.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, they've managed to figure out a way to do a lot of the stuff in a more economical format where everybody's standing around talking in the superhero lair or whatever where they have to reflect the realities of a TV budget versus a movie budget. So you might want to just check that out, you know, academically, just to see. I'd be interested in your thoughts about that.
I will. When it gets, maybe I'll pay attention to the premiere this year. This season. I will say this. I don't think superheroes as a genre are sort of overtaking television. I just think they're kind of a percentage of what's on. I guess it's ABC that has Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. Do they have a new one or so this year?
Well, they had this Agent Carter that came on in a midwinter kind of fill-in type show. And then I think there may be another one scheduled for midwinter next year, a third S.H.I.E.L.D. type program.
Is this a group of shows that appeals to you personally, Rick?
You know, it's interesting. Some of them do, some of them don't, and it all sort of depends on the franchise. None of them are among the ones that I watch more religiously. I kind of go in and out of some of them, but. I tend to be more along the lines of the TV snob type. I'm probably going to be covering Fargo this fall for not just another TV site.com. And I certainly miss Mad Men and Breaking Bad and shows like that.
Well, I'll
say
this.
So.
You know what's a good superhero approach is what they're doing on Gotham.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's almost not a superhero, almost. You know, the sort of Batman as a boy kind of thing. I mean, it's...
Well, an origin story, yes. That's a frontier that I think there's definitely a lot that you can do with on that. And I've always been fascinated by that. You know, in the end, you know how it turns out in terms of anything like Smallville or anything else like that. And yet it doesn't seem to affect the people who really invest in the shows. They don't seem to be bothered by the fact that you know that your hero lives through all of this stuff. So the meta suspense is really interesting.
They make it interesting. I mean, they make it an interesting story, so I guess that's all it took.
There was that joke at the upfronts last year about Gotham where they said, it has everything that you love about Batman except Batman.
That's pretty good, actually.
And I read somewhere that they are doing some retooling for season two, but I don't remember whether it was to make it more superheroic or less superheroic or move the storyline along and get to the Batman's coming out party faster or what. But that's stuck in my mind that there's something going on for the second season.
Very interesting. Well, something I want to talk about as well here, I'll start with you on this one, Adam, something that had been referenced earlier by Stuart, and that being the state of sitcoms these days. And you don't have too many big hits out there, ongoing ones outside of course, The Big Bang Theory, which year after year has been a monster franchise. Time for a little conflict of interest here on the show as we shill Undateable. As a good friend, FDH Lounge dignitary and 21st Century Media Alliance member Bob Glassman, of course, his nephew, the talented comedian Rick Glassman on that show. They're going to be all live on Friday nights. A great cast as well, even beyond Rick. Chris D'Elia, I'm a big fan of his. Ron Funches, as a Kroll show completist, I have really grown to love his act as well. And a great cast. They're being thrown into an interesting situation. I believe it's the first non-variety live show on networks in about 40 years. So a relatively soft, I would think, time spot, Friday nights at 8 o'clock. I mean, you could do better, you could do worse in terms of time spots. I think the later you go on Friday nights, the worse it probably gets, and you certainly wouldn't want to be on Saturdays. But what are your thoughts about how they're taking, again, what I think even they would admit is a gimmick as far as the live performances, but trying to use it to play off of the improvisational skills of their crew?
Well, the live, you know, the idea of going live is sort of semi-hot right now. It's what networks think, in particular NBC, think is sort of an antidote to, you know, time shifting and DVRing of television shows, and in the process of DVRing, you know, fast forwarding through commercials. The idea taken, I guess, in a small way from, you know, the live musicals that NBC has been doing every Christmas lately, and saying to themselves, hey, let's make a sitcom that's live, because some of their sitcoms occasionally did these live, you know, these live episodes as stunts. So they must feel like they know how to do it, and they may believe that people will tune in to see a live show for what? The expectation that it's like watching a car race and someone will crash? I don't really know. I mean, I would discount that expectation. I don't think it's like the 1950s where, like, you know, a ladder is going to fall in the background or something. but nevertheless, this sort of seat of your pants sort of live television is an interesting idea. From the few that I've seen, though, to the average viewer, they don't look any different, you know, than the shows that are recorded. One of the interesting experiments is actually premiering tonight, this first time ever show with Neil Patrick Harris. That's on tonight. It's getting an early premiere, and in a way, that's an even riskier experiment, only because it's supposed to be a seat of your pants, taking risks kind of live show. Now, that's how they build it. I don't know how many segments are live or how many are not live, or maybe only Neil Patrick Harris is live. But that, too, is an NBC attempt to see if live events, you know, I guess modeled after live sports, although certainly sports has attributes that, you know, a Neil Patrick Harris variety show cannot equal, that people will tune in because it's live and it's a live event that would not lend itself to watching on tape later. Now, one would argue that you could record first time ever and have just as much fun watching it. Now, I don't know what will be unique about it tonight that you had to tune in between 10 and 11 Eastern time to see it. And that's my way of saying I wish them well with their live sitcom. I hope it's a gimmick that works, but I also think that it may not look so different from a regular sitcom that anybody will really notice and say, hey, you got to watch this live sitcom. These people are really out there on a cliff or something. I mean, when they're really not, you know. So.
Well, you know, it's very interesting. They played it up in a meta sense when they did the live special back in May of how these very talented comedians and the majority of the cast actually does stand-up comedy on a regular basis, how they were going to try and make each other break. And there were a few instances in watching it where it either happened or just about happened, so I think they're trying to draw in people on that level. Like you said, maybe a little bit of the car crash element, maybe a ladder doesn't fall, but somebody may look like a dummy in the moment here, and the audience is kind of laughing at them rather than with them. So.
Well, I always come out against improv comedy for the most part. I mean, the one exception for me was sort of the semi-improv of Curb Your Enthusiasm, where they would just write these basic outlines for these interchanges and scenes that they would have, and somehow the improv would turn out well. But after Curb premiered and became a hit, there was a slew of other shows that were, you know, these sort of like single camera, half or if not total improv kinds of sitcoms, and you'd see them on networks like TBS and this kind of thing, and Comedy Central. I remember a whole slew of them in the early 2000s, and they were all terrible because the improv was terrible, and they were snickering at each other, and it was just amateur hour. So I hope that they don't rely on that. It's like the old Carol Burnett show when Tim Conway used to crack up Harvey Korman, but then which was charming at first, but after a while they sort of did it in such a way that you knew they were acting.
Right.
So it was just sort of ruined.
It's hard to do well. It really is. I'm a fanatic about the show, The League, and they have a couple guys on there that are very talented improvisers. And
well, I can imagine
again,
you would love that show. Yeah.
Oh, my God, I love that show. I am a completist of it. And, again, Nick Kroll is my favorite comedian, but the rest of the cast is really just amazing as well. And they do the same sort of semi-scripted stuff, and they manage to pull it off pretty well, largely because when it's a show that's largely around a bunch of guys that are breaking each other's balls on a regular basis, it's hard to know when, you know, when the actor's laughing or when the character's laughing. So you don't get distracted by that as much. You know, it's kind of an interesting kind of a zone there. But Stuart, what's your sense as far as, again, I know one of the most important things on your beat has to be advertisers worried about the DVR effect. That's been a big thing in the last couple of years here, and that's why sports rights have escalated and why Vince McMahon has tried to jump on the bandwagon after all these years. We're not sports. We're not sports. Wait, you're paying more for sports. We're sports again. This sense that if something's live, you need to pay more for it because it's supposedly DVR proof. Our networks, obviously, this is a way that NBC is trying to find around that.
That's a very big thing right now, clearly.
Sure.
And it continues to be. And the idea that more and more stuff that's on the air is going to be live, whether it's sports or reality or scripted programs where they're going to try to do the productions live, although with, of course, quite a lot of rehearsal and blocking. I think that's one of the reasons why a lot of the stuff that's been these live experiments of late haven't really been that outstanding, is because I think they over-rehearse them because they're so terrified that, oh, nobody's done a live show in 60 years. Nobody knows how to do it. We better rehearse it 38 times. And then by the time it comes on live, all the juice has been
Well, that's true. I mean,
it's
because screwing up would be terrible. It's not like if they did, like, live. Remember when that musical Spider-Man kept, you know, they kept like, hanging the Spider-Man up in the ceiling? And, you know, that would happen. If that happened on TV, that would kind of be a disaster, even though I guess they kind of sort of want.
Well, they always have a plan B. I mean, they
I
talk
so.
About they have things that they have in case this happens or that happens, they can cut away to this or insert this number instead of that number. I think one of the interesting things about the being live, and this is something that TV Land, of all the networks in the world, TV Land not that long ago, was when they did their live, they did a couple of their sitcoms live, and they did the commercials live. And the cast delivered the commercials. So you were bringing back a whole bunch of things from the golden age of television. You were bringing back sponsors. Mm. You were bringing back live ads. And you were bringing back what they call cast commercials. So I think ability to have the programming live and have people tune in, because it's like, oh, you have to watch it in the moment. You don't know what's going to happen. That can be extended to the advertising in those shows. And again, there's that going back to the days of television and radio. The commercials were considered part of the show, and they were considered part of the entertainment. And some of the flubs and crack ups of the announcers and cast delivering the spots have been preserved for the ages, and they're quite funny even to this day. And I think there's going to be more of a of people trying that out and complementing the live programming with live advertising.
This is what advertisers are demanding, isn't it, Stu? I mean, they want this sort of never mind that it has its roots in the 1950s. It's considered
right.
innovative.
They do.
It would play on YouTube.
Again, but part of it is it's expensive, and they haven't done it before, or they haven't done it in a long time, and the idea that to go back to the original days when you had one sponsor of a show. Nowadays, the costs involved in that would be enormous. I mean, that's why the model of 32 advertisers appearing during your hour-long drama developed, because the feeling was, this episode costs millions of dollars to produce. One advertiser, two advertisers don't have the wherewithal to support that. So, the nice thing about the old days of television is a lot fewer commercial breaks and a lot fewer commercials during each break.
That's right.
Because you had the sponsor, they said, well, look, we got our name at the beginning, we get our name at the end, we may have a cast commercial, we don't need 30 spots in the break. We can do two spots in each break and only have like four breaks during the entire show. And everybody liked that. Everybody was very happy with that.
Well, and to go back to what you said,
the viewers.
Right. It was successful, and more recently with what you were talking about, Stuart, with TV Land working this in again, that is something that is true to their brand, because they are built on nostalgia, and to a lot of people who actually remember those days and appreciate those shows and those kind of nuances to it. I guess the overall theme for what we've been talking about here tonight is being true to your brand and making it work, whether it be TV Land in that instance, whether it be CBS, knowing what they want to do and making a go of it, or the prime times with the recent trend of superheroes and comic characters. It's all about knowing what you're trying to do and executing it successfully. And certainly, whenever we have a conversation with the likes of you gentlemen, that is always the case on this show. A pleasure to have both of you on with us here today. Stuart Elliott from Media Village, and FDA's Lounge dignitary Adam Buckman from Media Post and TV Howl. Thank you guys both so much for being here. Looking forward to having you both back on to talk TV in the near future. Thank you, guys.
Anytime, Rick. Thank you.
Thank you. Really enjoyed it, Rick.
Really appreciate it. Great quality conversation from you two, and I know the audience appreciated it as well. And speaking of the audience, thank you all, everybody, for tuning in to FDH Lounge mini-episode number 603.
As we bring the show to a close, we would like to extend our deepest gratitude to NBC, CBS, ABC, Fox, All Clear Channel affiliates, TNT, TBS, USA, UPN, Deadspin.com, YouTube.com, YTMND.com, MySpace.com, various blogs, Fox News, CNN, CNBC, MSNBC, IamBored.com, Billboard.com, Google.com, ESPN, ESPN2, ESPN News, ESPN Classic, NBA TV, NFL Network, Sports Timeout,
Ohio, Athlon Magazine, Comedy Central, Cartoon Network, The Boomerang Channel, QVC, BET, The Spice Channel, Steno Notebooks, Manwich, Papermate Office Supplies, Waitresses, Strippers, Bartenders, Garbage Men, Janitors, Microwave Popcorn, The Writers of The Office, Scrubs, Entourage, My Name is Earl, Oz, Metalocalypse and the Boondocks, Awkwafina, and The Periodic Table of Elements.